Gospel of Matthew as we read a portion of the very famous Christmas story. Tonight I'll read all the four sections of the Christmas story to make the message of our Christmas complete. But today we're going to focus on one aspect I called, "And the Magi Marveled." So if you would, Matthew chapter 2, we'll begin verses 1 and 2, I called "A Visit from the East." Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and have come to worship him." Wise men from the east. There's no specifics given about these guys, but in all probability, and I might have to step away from the pulpit because this is a scholarly opinion. I'm not the scholar. But in all probability, these men were from the Parthian Empire. The Parthian Empire. And let me give you a little bit of history. At one point in the history of the Middle East, the Medes and the Persians governed the Middle East. We talked about that when we studied a little bit about Daniel. Because Daniel lived in the Babylonian Empire, and the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And that empire lasted for a time. Well, during a course of history, the Medes tried to overthrow the political power of the Persians, the two tribes that got along to conquer that portion of the Middle East. They eventually decided to be at odds with one another. Amazing how that thing happens, isn't it? But the Persians were too strong, and the attempt failed. And from that time forward, the Median tribe changed from all political ambitions to religious ones. They became a tribe of priests. William Barclay, one of my favorite scholars, writes this: "They became in Persia almost exactly what the Levites were in Israel. They became teachers and instructors of the Persian kings. In Persia, no sacrifice could be offered unless one of the Magi were present. These Magi were men who were skilled in philosophy and natural science. They were soothsayers and interpreters of dreams." Well, this tribe of Magi were highly regarded, and one of their duties was to see to the orderly transition of government. They would be the ones who would physically crown a new king in Persia. Well, as history went on, the Persian Empire faded into history. It was conquered by Alexander the Great. Later on, the Romans would conquer the Greeks, and you sort of know the background of that. But eventually, the Parthian Empire would arise in what we call modern-day Iran. And the Parthian Empire would include sections of what used to be in the Babylonian and Persian Empire, which would include Babylonia. And here's the thing. The Romans never conquered the Parthians. They tried to, but the Parthians were too strong. So the Romans made an uneasy truce with the Parthians, sort of like the United States and North Korea, just sort of a detente, a ceasefire. Oh, we are not going to bother you. You don't bother us. And these tribes, this tribe of the Medians, the Magi, they continued on. They continued in history, and they became to the Parthians what they had been earlier in history to the Persians. They were the scientists of their day. They studied nature. They studied the stars. They read ancient writings. They were educated and respected. They were priests and advisors to the Parthian court as they had been to the Persian court centuries before. And in our story, a group of them come to Israel. Well, why? Because, as you know, the Christmas story, they saw a new star in the sky. In the thinking of the ancient world, a change in the heavens meant a change on earth. These men who were astrologers, one of their duties, they saw this star, and they had access to Jewish writings. Daniel had been in Babylon, which became Persia, which later on was adopted by Parthia. They had access to Jewish writings. And perhaps, we don't know, perhaps they read this verse. Let's look at Numbers 24, verse 17. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab, and break down all the sons of Seth." Jewish writing made centuries before about a person coming into power and symbolically with a star. Well, what was this star that these guys saw there in Iran that led them to Israel? There have been a lot of theories over the years. In 11 B.C., Halley's Comet was seen shooting across the sky. About 7 B.C., there was a brilliant conjugation of Saturn and Jupiter. Between the years of 7 B.C. and 2 B.C., there was a special brightness of the star Sirius. You have the radio function in your car, that's where it comes from, that star. And that star arose very brightly at sunrise on a particular day of the year, on the first day of the Egyptian month Masorai. Now, in the month Masorai, and the word Masorai means birth of a prince. And that star would shine very brightly that one day of the year, 6 years straight. That got somebody's attention, I assure you. But in truth, we really don't know what the star was. Whatever it was something that God used. You know, people assume when they hear the word supernatural that that means magical. Supernatural doesn't mean magical. Supernatural means above what we understand. There was a time in history when gravity would have been considered supernatural. God just uses His universe beyond ways we can comprehend. And God did something, that there was a light in the sky. And this group of Magi decided to travel to Israel to honor this new king that they were certain from the writings that they had access to and the star that they witnessed, they were certain was arriving. Well, how many were there? We don't know. The idea of three kings or three Magi comes from the fact there were three gifts, but we really don't know how many there were. Did they ride camels? We don't know that either. That's just a tradition. But what we do know is that being emissaries from a foreign country, they probably would have traveled with a military escort. They probably would have had cavalry to guard them and their treasures as they represented the Parthian Empire. And the Parthian Empire was in an uneasy truce with Rome. So this military-led caravan from a foreign country comes to the puppet king of Rome and has a question. Where's the new king? These guys whose job it was to crown kings comes to Herod and says, where's the new king? Parthian Empire, soldiers at his doorstep. Well, you know, that'd be kind of like a group of delegation from North Korea coming to the White House and says, where's the new president? Maybe that wouldn't be a bad idea. Oh, I'm sorry. Herod was troubled. This was a tricky political situation. He knew that he served the Romans, and the Romans had an uneasy truce with the Parthians because the Romans couldn't beat the Parthians. And he ain't got much of an army. Here's this delegation coming to him saying, where's the new king? He was really upset. But he was also upset because of the kind of man he was. So let's read about what I call the crafty king, verses 3 through 8. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. Herod was a crafty politician. He had always been a crafty politician. He had gained favor with Rome way back in 47 B.C. when he struck up a friendship with Mark Antony. And with Mark Antony's help, he actually had been appointed governor of Palestine. And he got the territory. And then in 40 B.C., by the way, B.C. years go backwards, so 40 B.C. is 7 years later than 47 B.C. In 40 B.C., he was able to get the Roman Senate's approval to receive the title of king. And he ruled as a puppet king under the Roman Senate. And he ruled for over 30 years. Now, Herod was not a natural-born Jew. In fact, he was an Edomian, an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. This tribe that he was a descendant of were traditional enemies of the Jews. So he, quote-unquote, converted to Judaism for political reasons so that he could technically be a Jewish king. The religious men of Judah always were highly suspicious of him. Nevertheless, Herod ruled the country well enough to keep order and satisfy his Roman overlords. He became known as Herod the Great, not because he was a great person, but because he was an industrious builder. Herod loved to build things. He built a number of buildings in Jerusalem, and most of all, he added a number of additions to the temple. He expanded the temple. Herod could be generous. In times of difficulty, he actually remitted taxes for the people. Can you imagine the president saying, well, for the next 6 months, nobody has to pay income tax because it's a hard time? We'd take that one, though, wouldn't we? In 25 B.C., Herod melted down his own gold plate to buy corn for starving people. He could come off as a decent guy every once in a while. But Herod had one terrible flaw. He was insanely suspicious. He murdered his eldest son, Antipater, along with two other sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, because he considered that they were rivals to his throne. He murdered one of his wives. By the way, the guy had seven wives in his lifetime. He murdered his wife, Mary Ann, and her mother, Alexandra. Caesar Augustus, the Roman emperor, was quoted as bitterly saying, "It was safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son." Anybody Herod considered to be a rival to his throne, he had assassinated. So here you have a man who killed his wife, killed his mother-in-law, and killed three of his boys because he thought they might have designs on his throne. And all of a sudden, there's a delegation from the Parthian Empire that says, "Where's the new king?" That upset him. And that upset the people of Jerusalem, because they knew what kind of man he was. They knew how ruthless he was and how insecure he was. They knew the character of the guy they had as their leader. Now, something of the character of Herod can be seen in an event that would happen a few years later. So this would happen after the Christmas story, but when Herod reached the age of 70, his health declined rapidly, and he knew that he was going to die. He retired to his favorite city, Jericho. And when he did that, he ordered that his soldiers arrest a collection of distinguished citizens in Jerusalem on trumped-up charges and hold them in prison. And he ordered that when he died there in Jericho, that the soldiers were to kill all those men in Jerusalem. Because he said, "I know that nobody's going to mourn for me, but I want tears shed on the day of my death." That's the kind of character this fellow had. Now, fortunately, in history, that order was rescinded by Herod's sister and it was not carried out. But you can see how this kind of a man would react when a delegation of magi come to him and say, "Where's the new king? We're here to worship him." Well, in somewhere in the conversation he had with them, they informed him that they were talking about what they read in Scripture. Because he understands that they're talking about Messiah. He understands that. That you'd think that he would say, "Oh, Messiah is born? Wonderful! God's promise is coming to us. That's great!" Not how he responded, is it? Look at verse 4 again. "And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ," he understands it to be Messiah, "where the Christ was to be born." He got them all together. He asked his top dog religious scholars, "Where's the Messiah to be born?" And they gave him the answer. "Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem." Bethlehem, King Herod down the road. Bethlehem, a tiny village about 6 miles away from Jerusalem. It was situated high on a gray limestone ridge, some 2,500 feet high. The ridge had a summit at each end with sort of a lower part in the middle, kind of like a saddle. And the homes were built between the two ridges. And the limestone ridge allowed for their caves to be there. And a lot of people used the caves as stables. Bethlehem from a distance looked like an amphitheater of hills. In ancient days, Bethlehem was the location where Jacob had buried his favorite wife, Rachel. And then later in history, Ruth from the Old Testament was buried there. She lived there. But its claim to fame, of course, was that that was the village that King David was born in. The name Bethlehem means house of bread. The countryside was fertile and could grow crops, which is unusual in Judea. But isn't it fitting that the bread of life was born there? The scripture had pointed to this little village as the birthplace of Messiah more than 700 years before. And that's exactly where Jesus was born. So Herod summoned the Magi. He gets them secretly, and he talks to them. Look at verse 7 again. Then Herod summoned the Magi secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. Isn't it interesting that his own people had surely seen the star? Those same high priests and scribes had surely seen the light in the sky. But it didn't seem to move them. Didn't seem to inspire them. Herod gives the instruction. I want you to go check this out. He tells the Magi. He sent them to Bethlehem saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. We all know that's a lie. But these guys from Parthian Empire didn't know that. They didn't know much about Herod. So they believe it. And they take off. And they find the Christ child. So let's continue on in our story, what I call gifts in picture. Verses 9 through 11. After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother. And they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, and frankincense, and myrrh. Whatever the light in the sky was, it didn't shine all the time. It shined when Jesus was born. It shined that night that they were going to find him. They saw it again, and it led them to Bethlehem. Maybe this is the language of appearance, and it gave the appearance with the rotation of the earth and the light of the sky that it was above Bethlehem. Or maybe that's literal. I don't know. I just know that God maneuvered things so that it pointed these guys to where Mary and the Christ child were. They were overjoyed when they saw the light in the sky. And they came to the house. You folks probably already know this, but this event does not take place Christmas Day. We have it in the manger scene. We also show the wise men coming the night Jesus was born, but that's just for traditional sake. The fact of the matter is, these Magi appear to Mary and Joseph anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half after Jesus was born. At this point, Joseph and Mary have decided to settle down and stay in Bethlehem. Joseph had begun working somewhere in Bethlehem. They had a house in Bethlehem. They were making a new life as a new couple with a new family in Bethlehem with full intention of staying put. God would change that, but that was what was happening at that moment. And here these guys show up at Mary's door. Can you imagine how she reacted? A poor peasant woman, and there's a knock on the door, and she goes to the door and opens it up, and there's this delegation with royal attire of all these guys coming to her house, and she's, whoa, what's going on? And they say, we're here to see the child. We're here to see the child. So she lets them in. They come in, and they see toddler Jesus. And they bowed down. They got on their knees and worshiped him. And then they presented gifts. You know, it's interesting. In the Christmas story, when the announcement is made to the shepherds, and the shepherds go see Mary and Joseph and the new baby on Christmas Day, the shepherds were Jews, and they were poor. And here in this event, the visitors are Gentiles, and they are rich. And it illustrates the point that Jesus came for everybody. He came for everybody, from one end of the spectrum to the other. He came for all. And so, these fellows presented their gifts to Jesus. And you know the story. One of them gave him gold. And gold symbolizes royalty. I'm sure God prompted these guys to give these three gifts because these three gifts have symbolic meaning. And one of them gave him gold, and that symbolized he really is a king. And then one of them gave him frankincense, and frankincense was a substance used by the priests. And that symbolizes that Jesus is a priest. And one of them gave him myrrh, which is a bitter ointment that was used by the undertakers of that day to prepare the dead for burial. And did you know that those three gifts picture the ministry of Jesus? He was the king of Israel. He was the priest who would bring us to God. And he was the one who would die to suffer on our sake. I wonder what Mary thought about those gifts. I wonder what she thought as these foreigners in their foreign attire and their retinue of people with them come into her little peasant house and bow down before her son and give him three gifts that are so unusual. I wonder what she thought. I wonder how the conversation went that afternoon or that evening. I guess it was nighttime since the star was there that night. And then I really wonder what she said to Joseph when he came back from work. Because the indication is he is not there. Hey, honey, I've got news for you. While you were off on your trip buying supplies, look here. We had some visitors. And they gave us gold and frankincense and myrrh and honored our boy Jesus. I think that would have gotten his attention. Well, let's read the last verse. I call divine protection, verse 12. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. It's interesting that God spoke to these men in a dream. That was their function, was interpreting dreams. And God said to them, all three of them, don't go back to Herod. Go home differently. And they honored that directive. When they woke up the next morning, they packed up and went home to Parthia in a different direction, a different route. I wonder what they spoke about on the way. This was a long trip. A long trip. It had taken them probably a couple of months to go from where they were to this, because they had to go up and then go back down, follow the water, go up, go back down to get. And so it would take them a number of weeks to go home. I wonder what they talked about. Did they marvel that this new king was born in such a poor household? Did they wonder what would happen to him in the future? Surely they knew they were right about him. I mean, the star led them and they had a dream, a divine inspiration telling them not to go back to Herod. They knew God had spoken. But I bet they went back as changed men. You see, nobody who honestly comes to Jesus ever leaves as the same person. Meeting Jesus changes people. It did then, and it does now. Now, actually, God did protect his son, and you know the rest of the story. Satan, working through Herod, wanted to destroy this Messiah. Isn't that amazing that Herod wanted to kill the Messiah? But God would give Joseph a dream also. And God would instruct Joseph to pick up the family and leave and go to Egypt. That was out of Herod's jurisdiction. The city of Alexandria, Egypt, had a very large Jewish population. I'm told there was over 1 million Jews that lived in Egypt at that point in history. And so this little family of three could easily blend in. And isn't it interesting that I'm sure that Joseph used the gold, sold the myrrh, and sold the frankincense for money to pay the expenses for this trip to Egypt and to live there for a number of months and then to come back. God had provided the financing for this excursion. God had protected his son from harm. And later, as you know the story, he would instruct the family to move to Nazareth, where Joseph and Mary had originally started from. They had not intended on going there at first, but God told them to go there. And there in that trading town in the province of Galilee, Jesus would grow up. Nazareth was not a big town, nor was it an important town. In fact, it was looked down upon by the people of the day. They used to have a saying, "Could anything good come out of Nazareth?" The implication is no. It's redneck village. Yeah, that's exactly where Jesus grew up. He would be born in a poor place and grow up in a despised place. Yet he really was the king. He really was the priest. And he really was the one who's destined to die. God moves in mysterious ways. But before we conclude the story, I want to focus for just a moment on the four different responses to Jesus that this story illustrates. First of all, from Herod, there's the reaction of hostility. Herod hated Jesus. Herod saw Jesus as a rival. Herod wanted to get rid of Jesus. He had hostility. And obviously we know there's hostility to Jesus right now. There's hostility to Christianity right now. From the priests, there's the amazing reaction of indifference. They saw the light in the sky. How could you not? When the king summoned them in the middle of the night to tell him where the Messiah was going to be born, surely somebody thought, well, why is the king Herod doing this? Why are we having a Bible study when these emissaries from Parthia come to see us? What's going on? And yet these guys were not interested enough to travel the 6 miles to Bethlehem, even as the emissaries had traveled over 600 miles to go there. They were just indifferent. You know, there's people today that are just really indifferent about Christmas. Okay. That's okay. Okay. From the townspeople, there was the reaction of trouble. Oh, man, this is going to get serious. This is going to be a mess. This is going to mess up our schedule. This is going to mess up our day. The king is going to be upset. He's going to do something rash. This is not good. And for a lot of people, Christmas is just a time of trouble. Oh, I got to buy presents for Uncle Joe and Aunt Susie and whoever. I got to go to this party. I got to go to that. I'll be glad when it's all over with. It's just trouble for some people. But then there was the reaction of the Magi, of worship. They came to worship. They came to honor. So the question is, how do you come to Christmas? How do you come to Christmas? Is it just a fun holiday with family and friends? That's what the secular world puts it out to be. Is it a bother because you feel obligated to buy a lot of stuff for other people? Or is it a time when you realize that God loves you even as you are? God loves me knowing my weaknesses, and God loves you knowing yours. How do we come to Christmas? I hope it's like the Magi. I hope we'll marvel at the love of God that's illustrated in Christmas. Christmas is a wonder of incarnation, a wonder of virgin birth, a wonder of love that reached down to the lowest of the low to bring us up to the highest of the high. Jesus came down to where we are to take us back to where He is now. I wonder. I'd like to finish our message today with something I've used before. I've used it before. And brothers and sisters, if I could use this every year, I would. But I won't do that. But I read this so long ago, I copied it on a typewriter paper. That's how old this is. But it's a narration by Bob Benson. Noel Jesus is born. I'll read this and we'll conclude. Well, he still comes into a crowded world. It was crowded then, more crowded now. We lead such busy, jostling, cluttered lives, and they're even more so at Christmas. We come home loaded with bundles of gifts of love for others, but we get impatient and blow our horns at the cars ahead of us. Hardly time enough to buy a tree. We frantically wrap the last of the packages just moments before we tear them open so that we can rush off to somewhere else and back again, exhausted. Here we are at Christmas again, hoping to hear the angels singing, needing a star to follow, really wanting to kneel at a manger. We mean to adore him with Mary, and we do believe with Joseph. We want to worship with the shepherds. Our hearts long to rejoice with the wise men, but somehow there isn't any time. It's into just such a world that the angels come again and again to sing those life-giving words, Jesus is born. Jesus is born. Just as those words came and changed a barn filled with cows and straw into a shrine, a hillside dotted with sheep and shepherds into a cathedral, a sky filled with stars into a message from our Father, so they come to you. They are as old as eternity, as fresh as the morning, as simple as a baby, as majestic as a song, as warm as a mother's arms, and as mighty as God Himself. Jesus is born. Jesus is born. Jesus is born. Noel! You know, all of our celebrations of Christmas begin with Him there at the manger. We say, Merry Christmas, because He's our joy. Goodwill, because He's our peace. Good tidings, because He's our proclamation. Good cheer, because He's our hope. Emmanuel, because He is with us. Jesus is born. The light shined in the darkness, and it still shines and shines. And when our lights begin to flicker and die, when those with whom we've long celebrated are gone, when we can no longer sit at a table and share a meal or exchange gifts around the tree or sing the songs, it will still be Christmas because Jesus is born. Noel. Let's bow.